There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, bringing you the best of my Times Radio show. You can listen live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1. And if you can't get enough of it, you can come and see me live if you come on my tour. We're taking the radio show around the country. I'm also doing stand-up. You can go to mattchorley.com for all the details of that. Right, coming up on today's episode, just a small matter of war and how to avert it. We'll unpick exactly what's happening between Russia and Ukraine and what it means for the region and for Britain too. So it's your sort of complete guide to making sense of what's happening there. That's coming up in just a moment. But first, as ever, we kick off with our columnist panel on a Monday. It is Libby Rachie, so it's Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester.
So I suppose we should, if we're talking politics, let's start with the latest. Just when lying, rule-breaking, intimidation and bribery was not enough, we now add allegations of Islamophobia to the mix, with the claims by Nusrat Ghani that she was fired from her job as a minister because of her Muslimness. It's been denied by Mark Spencer, the chief whip, and now yet another inquiry has been ordered. What do you make of this, Libby Purvis?
Well, there's at the moment, there's just too much stuff about early 2020. I mean, who drank what, who said what. And I would have more sympathy with Ms. Ghani if she had made more of a fuss about this a great deal earlier, because her attack is coming just in the middle of all these other attacks on the whips and on the government. But I think that the trouble is that when a party or a government seems to be fighting internally like a lot of rabid rats in a sack, then everybody loses all respect for all sides. So it's like the big ongoing row in Christchurch College in Oxford, you know, Dons versus Dean, which has now made this college a universal laughingstock and dismays all the rest of the university. Just flapping your filthiest linen around in public does not do any good. And I wish she had not brought it up right now in the middle of all these other accusations, you know, the blackmail accusations and so on. It just feels like a plot, even if it isn't a plot. So the timing is just awful. But all sympathies with her, and also some sympathies with the poor old chief whip, who Mark Spencer, who said, you know, no, these words were never said, and it's, by the way, it's me that never said them, just to clear it up. Which,
yes, I thought that was a yes. I just want to be absolutely clear that I completely deny the thing that, but it was me, but it was not, it wasn't me. As a defence, is up there with all the other slightly strange.
I mean, does this make us all respect government? Does it?
Rachel, your assessment of it.
Well, I agree with you about the sort of Mark Spencer tweet. There obviously was some conversation that he could identify as having been involved in. So that was really strange. But for me, the thing that's most significant about this is I actually don't agree with Libby, because I think it does matter. And I think it raises more questions about Boris Johnson's judgment, because Nusrat Ghani did go to the Prime Minister and raise her concerns and say what had happened. And he sort of brushed it aside and said, oh, go and, you know, talk to the party about it. It's an internal party matter, which, of course, it wasn't, because it was to do with her government position. So it sort of raises questions about his, both the sort of lack of compassion. I mean, you imagine if an employee comes to you and says, look, I've had these terrible Islamophobic things said to me, just on a sort of personal level, the sort of lack of emotional intelligence, just to sort of brush that aside, but also on the kind of actual substantial political judgment, just to sort of say, try and send her off to the Tory party inquiry. That just shows a sort of complete lack of judgment from the Prime Minister. That, for me, is the significant thing about this.
And I suppose that's the thing, is it's sort of, we've now reached the point, Libby, that I take your point about the timing of it, and it does look like, you know, and it's easy, I suppose it's easy for defenders of the Prime Minister to dismiss it as being all part of a plot. But it does just all add to the sense that this is this doesn't feel like a government that can get back on the front foot. That's the big question, isn't it? And there's an amazing story in the Times today from Henry Zeffman that some of these 2019 intake MPs are planning to submit, it's basically like a Freedom of Information request, a data release, which basically asks for all records that refer to them, which anyone can do, can go to a government body and ask for any details of them which are held. I mean, if MPs are going to try and basically get every time the chief whip has moaned about them in a WhatsApp or an email, it's impossible to get this genie back in the bottle, isn't it?
It is. And I mean, at the moment, we've got Ukraine, we've got the National Health Service buckling and straining at the seams. You know, we've got a huge economic lot of pain to come, you know, which is going to have to come. We've got the gas business, the fuel price business. All these things just need concentration from a lot of professionals, not a lot of people fretting about, you know, who said what to who when. You know, it's tough. I mean, you start to lose patience. And I mean, if the Labour Party, if Keir Starmer has any sense, he will, as I think it's Claire says this morning, you know, start to give us some quite sort of stern, costed, factual proposals for when they take over.
Yeah, and I think that there's a really sort of careful line, isn't it, Rachel, that the opposition have to walk. That they don't, because I think they basically realised they overreached on wallpaper last year and were seen to just be banging on about that at the expense of all else. And they need to sort of, yes, keep up the pressure on Boris Johnson for the, you know, the ins and outs of whipping and parties and so on, but actually focus on the real world a bit as well, so they don't just look like they're playing a sort of Westminster game all the time. And, you know, gas bills, climate change, war with Russia, they're all quite big things that the opposition need to have views on as well.
Definitely. And also the Conservative Party is doing a pretty good job of attacking itself. So in a way, the internal opposition is more powerful than the external opposition.
Well, we'll see. But I mean, yeah, who knows what will come out of it all towards the end of the week. Let's talk about your column today, Libby, because you've been talking about the careful snipping out of bits and pieces from BBC sitcoms.
Well, allegedly, yes, the radio sitcoms. Some very sort of attentive listener to BBC Sounds, which, by the way, I adore. I mean, the archive of fabulous old stuff, old drama and old, you know, from Golden Age drama and Golden Age comedy is absolutely wonderful. All my walks and bike rides have been held together in lockdown by that. But there's just this suggestion that, you know, odd little words, you know, like when Albert Steptoe says, "You look like a puffy Victorian poet," you know, and they click out that first adjective there, just starting, "You look like a Victorian poet." It's a pity, and is a sort of parallel with the thing people sometimes try to do to books, you know, because radio and books are much easier to cut than television and films are. It's that sort of sense that that culture can somehow be adjusted to be much nicer and more sort of politically correct and woke, if you like, in retrospect. And it just can't be. You know, I think we need to stare back bravely and say, good grief, you know, all those 1930s novels were full of casual anti-Semitism, you know, weren't they? Does this not tell us quite a lot about how civilised people were able to think? And then you think yourself, right, what are the things that we say now, which in the future people may think are a bit loathsome? And so I don't like the retrospective cutting. This is a tiny thing, the radio thing. And normally in television, you just get these ridiculous warnings saying, you know, expressions of a certain sort, you know, which were common in 1965. You know, may distress some people. That's fine, but actually cutting them out, I don't like. I think it's unhelpful in every way. And the one thing I really love is that when they do Rumpole of the Bailey repeats on Talking Pictures TV by John Mortimer, who defended Gay News and Oz and so on. You know, it's a terrific liberal barrister. He wrote it all. But it still has to have little warnings saying, you know, there may be certain expressions which could distress and upset modern listeners. I think we've got to look at the past with a clearer eye, I think.
Well, I mean, the most amazing thing about this story is the listener who spotted it and kept some... I mean, I don't know how... Did they listen to the one that went out and then find an old one? Because some of them are quite sort of, like you said, it's sort of half a sentence or a word just snipped out here and there just to...
Some people have recordings. They have the old archive recordings on tape of these things and then they listen to them on the air.
And you know
them
off by heart.
It's very cunning.
Yeah.
But we need these vigilant people, you see. These vigilant people in our midst. No, it's a light reflection, this column, but it just, you know, it's enabled to just look back and think how many books, you know, have got something in them which we can't approve of now in our very censorious way.
One of the things, Rachel, the last few weeks we've been watching, it's absolutely brilliant, and I can't believe it's been out. It's an American show called I'm Dying Up Here, and it's about basically the stand-up comedy world in LA in the 1970s. And it's based on the sort of true story of the Comedy Store, but has been fictionalised. And even then, there's a warning when you watch it about how some of what is said was, you know, about race and gender, and some people might find effect. And I think, but this isn't a documentary from the 1970s. This is just, I know that some of the views are going to be out of date because it's a drama set in the 1970s.
Yeah. I was watching Monty Python with the children the other day, and it seemed incredibly old-fashioned and antiquated, and all things like there was one sketch where a woman had a sort of load of milkmen in her bedroom or whatever. It just, the whole thing, all think of Carry On. It is, it's amazing how much our social values have moved on. And I thought that Libby's point was so good about actually label rather than topple, that you can't rewrite the past completely. It's a bit like with the statues. You know, where's it going to end? So what happens to Shakespeare or Chaucer or, you know, all
I think,
of these...
I think you've got to go right back to Jane Austen. I mean, frankly, the slut-shaming of Lydia Bennet in Pride and Prejudice is shocking. You know, she just expresses her due female sexuality while running off with Mr. Wickham. And we're all supposed to think this is dreadful, you see. Cut it.
Well, there also reaches a point where at what point are you cutting so much that actually you just make the decision not to show... You know, if this joke isn't acceptable, but that one sort of is, but they were both born out of the same time by the same people... You know, either leave it alone or just put something else on.
And also this stuff...
But everything changes all...
Sorry, go on, Rachel.
No, you can learn from what... You know, the world has moved on, and that's a good thing. But you can learn from looking at what values and what people did say, you know, 20, 30 or even 300 years ago. You can realise how much things have advanced. And that's a good thing.
Yeah, no, it's yeah,
I mean, I think one of the interesting things is an example I give of things we say now slowly falling out of fashion, thank goodness, is that dreadful acronym BAME, you know, black and minority ethnic, which sort of lumps together people from every kind of race and every, you know, every part of society. And people are now starting to say, actually, it's rather insulting just to lump us all as BAME. And I thought it was, you know, for ages ago, but that's now kind of falling out of use. But I think it'll be quite interesting for people to look back and say, gosh, people used to sort of say, oh, let's have more BAME employees. It's fascinating.
Yeah, and language evolves all the time. And I mean, and comedy evolves all the time. I mean, you know, the like you were saying, Rachel, sort of the old milkman's thing. It's just a really lame joke, that now.
I mean,
you know, it partly because, you know, it was done to death. It's not real.
But comedy particularly evolves, I think. And comedy, because it's sort of on the edge socially, you know, to work, then it's got to be slightly pushing the boundaries. So it's going to be at the edges of what becomes unacceptable.
Can I make a confession here?
Seeing
as I'm going to be
away for
2 weeks. Away for 2 weeks and getting off the social media, I thought the milkman sketch was quite funny, because when I was actually hearing about it from Rachel just now, I suddenly remembered the expression on all those gloomy, trapped milkmen's faces in the room, and that's what made it funny. You know, they were acting. They were acting it, and so in that second, it was funny. Yes, of course, it was sort of sexist and disgusting and ridiculous and lame, but on the other hand, it was funny.
And
but you see it through the eyes of a younger generation as well. That's what's so interesting. If you watch something with your children, you think, oh my goodness, I can't believe I've made them watch this. It's a sort of...
But also context. In comedy, context is so important. You know, I've heard Jimmy Carr talking about this recently, that something that he said, you know, something that he says to a room of his fans in the context of gradually, you know, warming them up and getting to the point of, you know, how offensive can his jokes get and all that sort of thing. Take one of those jokes and put it on the front of the Daily Mail and he looks like the most appalling person in the world.
Mm.
And context is so important in all of that as well.
Hear our breakfast table.
Well, there we are. There's a show for Times Radio. Live from Libby's breakfast table. Libby Purvis and Sylvester there. And of course, you can read them in the Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/times-webbox. Up next, can we avoid war?
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast now. It's time for this. How close are we to a war with Russia? Russian troops are massed on the Ukrainian border. Western allies are ramping up the rhetoric about the repercussions Russia would face if it does invade Ukraine. But the families of diplomatic staff from the US and the UK are being told to leave Ukraine as fears of an invasion rise. Front page of the Times reports this morning, ministers have been warned that a Russian invasion could lead to high oil and gas prices here. So what we thought we'd do this morning is take you through the escalation in the tensions and then try and examine exactly how we might find a way through this. One of the most striking comments we've had in the last week came from the Armed Forces Minister, James Heapy. He was on Times Radio last week and explained that a potential Russian invasion would be a war unlike any seen before.
What stands in front of us, what could be weeks away, is the first peer-on-peer industrialised, digitised, top-tier army against top-tier army war that's been on this continent for generations. Tens of thousands of people could die. This is not something that people in Moscow should believe to be bloodless. This is not something that the rest of the world should stand by and ignore. It's right that all diplomatic avenues are being exhausted. I just hope that as we're on the brink, people in Moscow start to reflect that thousands of people are going to die, and that is not something that anybody should be remotely relaxed about.
That was the Armed Forces James Heapy, Armed Forces Minister James Heapy, with a pretty frightening assessment of where we are. The US President Joe Biden has said that Russia will be held accountable and allies were ready to take action if they invade Ukraine.
I think he still does not want any full-blown war, number one. Number two, do I think he'll test the West, test the United States and NATO as significantly as he can? Yes, I think he will. But I think he'll pay a serious and dear price for it that he doesn't think now will cost him what it's going to cost him. And I think he'll regret having done it. Russia will be held accountable if it invades, and it depends on what it does. It's one thing if it's a minor incursion and then we end up having a fight about what to do and not do, et cetera. But if they actually do what they're capable of doing with the force amassed on the border, it is going to be a disaster for Russia if they further invade Ukraine, and that our allies and partners are ready to impose severe cost and significant harm on Russia and the Russian economy.
Here in Britain, Liz Truss, the Foreign Secretary, has been leading the diplomatic response, breaking off from a trip in Australia to warn that Russia faces consequences if it provokes a full-scale invasion of Ukraine.
There would be severe consequences should Vladimir Putin stage an incursion into Ukraine, economic consequences in particular, and that would have a very damaging effect. And the other point I would make, which I made in my speech, is this will not be, it would not be easy. The Ukrainians will fight this. This could end up as a quagmire, and I think that should be seriously considered by Russia.
That was Liz Truss speaking over the weekend. From Russia's perspective, the foreign minister there, Sergei Lavrov, insisting Russia's never threatened Ukraine.
As far as Ukraine is concerned, we talked about it. Once again, our American counterparts once again tried to push to the forefront the issues at the border between Russia and Ukraine. They tried to condition everything on the need of the so-called de-escalation, which has turned into some kind of a mantra. But I would like to reiterate once again, at the end of our meeting, we agreed that next week the US is going to present us with written answers to all of our proposals. And you also said, in particular, that Ukraine has represents no threat to Russia. And I would like to once again remind everyone who analyzes our public statements and our analysis, and I would like to say that never before has Russia threatened through its official representatives the Ukrainian people.
That was Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, speaking the end of last week. So what is really going on here? How do we get to this point and what happens next? Let's speak to the Times' diplomatic editor, Catherine Philp. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Matt.
Just because this is one of these things which has been bubbling away in the background, is now on the front pages and people might not have been following every twist and turn of this. Just explain, why is there this situation between Russia and Ukraine?
Sure. So late last year, Russia began moving troops to the border of Ukraine and just away from the border of Ukraine in vast numbers. Now at about 127,000, under the guise of military exercises. Now, obviously, this is not wholly credible, not least because Russia has previous form on this, having invaded one neighbour, Georgia, in 2008, and Ukraine itself in 2014, when it annexed Crimea. Russia then said that its real demand was a reorientation of European security, including pushing NATO back to its posture pre-1997. So the flurry of diplomatic activity we've seen over the past 2 weeks has been about the Russians meeting with first the US, then NATO, the full alliance, to discuss those demands. The problem is that NATO is simply not in a position to say, give guarantees such as Ukraine will never be allowed to join NATO, that is against its very constitution, and so are having to come up with other tidbits to tempt Russia into compliance. Meanwhile, the tempo of the military build-up is growing louder. Russia has now moved troops into Belarus, giving it an opportunity to attack Ukraine from the north. So there is nothing that is de-escalating in this situation at the moment.
We also heard this morning that NATO is putting forces on standby and deploying additional ships and fighter jets to Eastern Europe. So both sides seem, you know, it seems to be escalating. What do you think is the end point of this?
Well, I would I would point out that that deployment is not to Ukraine itself, and there's no intention of NATO to send troops to Ukraine. That is really a reassurance for our Baltic neighbours, who are the Baltic allies in NATO, Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, who are the countries that Moscow is pressing for NATO to pull out of. And it's something that they've asked for. And it's also essentially a way of showing Putin that if he doesn't back off, he's going to achieve the exact opposite of what he says he wants. I think that we're coming to something of a denouement potentially this week or next, because the Americans have been asked to submit written answers to Russia's demands, which they will do so this week. Now, what's interesting about this and the fact they've asked for them is that, as we know, Russia's a very authoritarian and centralized form of government, where Vladimir Putin is really the only one who makes the decisions. So I think, given that he's not been in any of these negotiations thus far, the written answers are a chance for him to look directly at what the Americans are offering in an unfiltered way that's not coming through any of his people. And Russia does have an interest in dragging out this diplomatic track as long as possible if it intends to attack Ukraine, because then it can say, well, we got nowhere. We tried. You failed us. So I think that that's the next big move that we're going to see.
And just on the diplomatic front, where is Britain in all of this? Peter Ricketts, former National Security Advisor, writing in the Times today, basically saying, where is the Prime Minister and the Foreign Secretary? Well, the Foreign Secretary has been in Australia and leaking some intelligence, which was seems to have gone off slightly half-cocked, this story that suggesting that Russian security were trying to replace the Ukrainian president with someone else.
Yes, well, I mean, firstly, I think you played a clip there of Liz Truss in Australia. You have to ask what on earth she was doing in Australia at a time of crisis for European security. Britain is becoming increasingly involved in the Asia Pacific region because in the belief that that's what America wants, that China is the great new threat, and so that we should be in that. A lot of people think we should be much more closely aligned with Europe, but as you may have noticed lately, Matt, we're not getting along very well with our European neighbours. And in fact, today the EU ministers are meeting to discuss Ukraine, and Antony Blinken, the US Secretary of State, will be dialing into that. Liz Truss will be in Brussels, but obviously not post-Brexit to attend that meeting. In fact, to talk about the Northern Ireland Protocol. She also missed a meeting last week, which was supposed to be between her counterparts in France and Germany, along with Antony Blinken when he was physically in Brussels. I see we have no way of checking the intelligence that she chose highly unusually to release over the weekend. The Americans have given it a sort of qualified health check, saying, well, these are the methods that Russia uses, without us really knowing whether the individuals that they've named in this alleged plot are credible plotters. But I think that move to release that intelligence does show kind of an attempt for Britain to sort of take a more muscular role, but also to have some singularity in it and differentiate itself from the Europeans. Obviously, it's not the US, so really that's the only role it can choose to play with the current posture towards the rest of Europe.
Yeah. Catherine Phillips, thank you so much for describing all of that so clearly for us. As Catherine Phillips is a diplomatic correspondent for The Times, she was mentioning EU foreign ministers are in Brussels today. And in fact, Ireland's Foreign Affairs Minister, Simon Coveney, arriving at that meeting, said that plans by Russia to hold Navy military exercises off the coast of Ireland are not welcome. The artillery drills are supposed to start next month in international waters, but within Irish-controlled airspace. And speaking this morning, as part of international requirements, Russia's informed Ireland what it's planning to do, but Simon Coveney said he's made it clear to the Russian ambassador in Ireland that it's not welcome. It's not a time to increase military activity and tension in the context of what is happening with and in Ukraine at the moment. So that's just something else, which is a sort of another front on all of this. Up next, let's hear from, as we've heard this morning, British diplomatic staff and their families being withdrawn from Kiev, at least some of them. Well, earlier in the programme, I spoke to Lee Turner, a former UK ambassador to Ukraine, and asked him whether this means a conflict is imminent.
It seems to me that we are in an extremely dangerous situation. There is, unfortunately, a significant chance that Russia will, or the Russian leadership, rather than the Russian people, I'm sure, will plunge Russia and Ukraine into a totally unnecessary war. And it's prudent for the British authorities to pull some of the non-essential staff out of Kiev because the risk of a conflict has grown.
Just describe us for us, how big is the embassy? What is the sort of the British diplomatic presence in Ukraine normally?
Well, there's a few dozen diplomats or UK-based staff, and a similar or slightly larger number of Ukrainian-based staff who are working there. I don't know how many people they're pulling out, but clearly a skeleton staff will be remaining there to do the important work of trying to keep a peace process on track and to make sure that the British government is properly informed of what is going on in Ukraine, and also to make sure that we can protect British interests in Ukraine as well as possible.
How good are relations between Britain and Ukraine? What role can Britain try to do to try to resolve this diplomatically, to try and step back from, as you were saying, what increasingly looks like we're marching towards some sort of conflict between Britain, between Russia and Ukraine?
The UK has always strongly supported the independence and sovereignty of Ukraine. We don't recognise the annexation of Crimea any more than any other country in the world does, even Belarus. Moscow's closest ally has not recognized the annexation of Ukraine. And to those people who say you'll never get it back, I would just say, look at the Baltic states, which after 1945, everybody said, well, they're part of the Soviet Union now. And in fact, they've become independent countries. So the UK will be pushing strongly to support diplomatic measures to talk to the Russians. That is part of what they want, to be seen at the top table of negotiations with the US, and we will also be trying to make Ukraine a bit pricklier in terms of increasing the cost to Russia should the Russian leadership, for their own very obscure reasons, decide to push for an actual armed conflict. That we all know that the Russian people, who are on the whole naturally very sensible, have no desire for a war. And they really don't want to see body bags coming back to Moscow, St. Petersburg, Novosibirsk and so on.
That was Lee Turner, a former British ambassador to the Ukraine, speaking to me a little earlier this morning. Let's now turn our attention to Liam Fox, Conservative MP and former Defence Secretary, who joins us now. Hi, Liam.
Good morning, Matt.
What is your assessment on what is happening in Russia and Ukraine right now and Britain's ability to do anything about it?
Well, it is a blatant act of aggression, and for Minister Lavrov to say that Russia poses no threat to Ukraine is laughable. Ukraine is still suffering from the occupation of part of its sovereign territory, which began in 2014. What we're seeing is a blatant act of aggression by Russia towards Ukraine, 100,000 troops around the border, threatening cities like Donetsk and Luhansk. And there is no reason for it, because the Ukraine poses no threat whatsoever to Russia. Now, you then have to ask, why is Russia acting? Well, Putin has had two types of behaviour. One is his claim that the protection of Russian citizens, ethnic Russians, lies with the Kremlin and not with the constitution or the laws of the countries in which those people live. And that's, of course, makes a mockery of our concept of international law. And he's also maintained the old Soviet view that Russia has a right to what they call a near abroad. In other words, they should have a veto over the foreign and security policies of their immediate geographical neighbours. And that goes against our entire understanding of self-determination. So we are faced with a Russia, some would say, that is probing the West's intent and the West's strength in defence following the self-inflicted humiliation of the Afghanistan withdrawal. I don't really buy that completely, because of the action in 2008 in Georgia and 2014 in Ukraine. This is an aggressive gangster regime that poses a real threat to its neighbours. And what we need to do is to, first of all, make it very clear that we will never accept the annexation of the Crimea, that we will always support the independence, the sovereignty and the self-determination of Ukraine, politically, economically. And that means that if Ukraine in time wants to move towards other Western institutions, including the EU or NATO, it has a right to do so if it fulfills the criteria and if those institutions want them to be part of it. So it's a very clear differentiation, I think, between those who believe in the international rule of law and those gangsters who don't.
When you were Defence Secretary and you oversaw a review of, you know, Britain's preparedness for various types of conflicts, and for a couple of decades before, it was always seen as something that might be played out in Afghanistan or Iraq. And you said then that we needed to think again about potential conflicts with, you know, a different type of conflict. Do you think that we are heading towards seeing a situation where Britain is embroiled in some sort of conflict between Ukraine and Russia?
Well, if there is a conflict between Ukraine and Russia, our choice is either to do nothing or do something. We can't do nothing because that would be to send a signal that we didn't believe in international law and that we didn't believe in defending the interests of countries whose self-determination is utmost. The question is how we would deal with that. Of course, you've got the physical environment and there's the option of providing Ukraine with further military equipment. Russia must understand, given what they endured in Afghanistan, for example, that they could be bogged down in a very costly conflict in terms of lives and money for them at absolutely no benefit to the Russian people. And likewise, their demands for NATO to remove its troops from the Baltic states is utterly something that we cannot accept. Countries have a right to belong to a defensive alliance if they want. And the reason that these countries want to see, as we have done, reinforcement of their security by NATO is because of the threat of Russia. It is Russia that is creating the problems, not the West, when it comes to European security.
And just finally, you're talking about if you have a choice between doing nothing and doing something, how problematic is it that in the coming weeks as this crisis unfolds, we either have a prime minister fighting for his political life or potentially a leadership contest to replace him?
Well, I've been arguing, as you know, here and elsewhere, that we need to look at all the issues in perspective and have a sense of proportion. And I think this is not the time for the Conservative Party to have a three-month period of navel gazing in a leadership election. We actually require stability. The last thing that we need as a country is for the Foreign Secretary or the Defence Secretary or others to be involved in leadership politics internally at a time when there's a major international crisis to face. The public may be angry about parties held in Downing Street, and they're right to be so, but parliamentarians need to have a sense of proportion about what is in our national interest and what are the wider issues where the UK needs to stand up and be counted at a time of international tension and danger.
Liam Fox, Conservative MP, former Defence Secretary, thanks very much for joining us on Times Radio this morning. Let's just turn our attention now to just the military aspect of all of this. David Lidington, former Theresa May's de facto deputy when she was Prime Minister, now heads the defence think tank RUSI, joins us. Hi, David.
Hi, good to speak to you, Matt.
We've also got Major General Tim Cross, a retired Army officer. Hi, Tim.
Good morning, Matt.
Just put into context for us, David Lidington, when James Heapy talks about a fully digitised war, the sort of war we haven't seen before, what does that look like?
Well, what it means is that Russia has available to it not only very weighty modern conventional forces, including long-range cruise missiles and the like, which one assumes they would use in a strike to try to knock out Ukrainian capabilities. But they also have cyber capabilities, and we've seen already in recent years Russian or Russian-sponsored cyber attacks on various European countries and entities. And I'm sure if the conflict were to break out, that that would be an element of it. What's true about Ukraine is that I agree with the commentators who say that Ukraine would find it very hard to resist an all-out Russian attack. The Ukrainian army is much better equipped, better trained than it was at the time of the first Russian invasion back in 2014. And there is also, I think, a greater sense now than there was in 2014 of Ukrainian nationhood and solidarity. I mean, it's ironic that one of the things Putin has achieved by his occupation of Crimea and his intervention in the Donbass in eastern Ukraine is actually to make most Russian-speaking Ukrainians feel more Ukrainian. And I remember as a minister going to Dnipropetrovsk, you know, overwhelmingly Russian-speaking city in the east of the country, and the Ukrainian blue and yellow flags absolutely everywhere. And so Putin's aggression is having the opposite effect in terms of Ukrainian opinion from the one he wants to see. But my fear is if Putin decides to act with the forces that he's got there, and he can't keep them, you know, sitting on their bayonets, as the proverb would have it, indefinitely, then it is going to be a pretty savage and all-out attack. That's what we saw in Chechnya. It's what we saw with the Russian intervention in Syria, and the Kremlin has shown in recent years that it has no compunction about large-scale loss of life if it helps it achieve its military objectives.
David Innocent, thank you for that. Just finally, Major General Tim Cross, what state is the British Army in right now? Well, you know, Liam Fox saying if Russia does invade, we've got a choice between doing something and doing nothing. Are we physically capable of doing something?
No, not. There's no way that NATO, UK included, is going to fight physically to defend Ukraine. We've been sending them weapons. We've been sending them training teams. And we have very, you know, pretty good close relationships with Ukraine. But there's no way that we are going to send a brigade or a division, as in the First or Second Gulf War or in the Balkans.
And so where does that leave us then? Just sort of saying, oh, stop it from the sidelines.
Well, no, I think it's more to it than that. I think just picking up the points that David made, when you assess these sorts of operations, under British Army doctrine, we talk about fighting power. And when we assess whether somebody's going to win or lose, we look at this equation of fighting power. And it consists of three components: the physical component, which is the stuff. And there's no doubt that Russia has got huge amounts of equipment. And if it decided to conduct a massive full-scale attack on Ukraine, it would be overwhelming force. Mm. But as David says, the Ukrainians have got much better capability than they did have, you know, a few years ago. The second component of fighting power is the conceptual. How do you actually conduct those operations? And the Russians, in addition to using overwhelming force, but nonetheless have developed this whole idea of hybrid warfare, gray zone warfare, using cyber, using all sorts of other issues below the threshold of conventional war, if you like. And there's certainly one option is that Putin will put more pressure on Ukraine and conduct these operations in that sort of gray zone. The third component is what we call the moral component of fighting power. It's the will to fight and the ability to get your guys to be prepared to die for the cause, in simple terms. And David's absolutely right. The Ukrainian moral component, I've got no doubt, that it is greater than, in inverted commas, the Russian component. The Ukrainians will fight for their country. And that's not to say the Russians, in the end, won't conduct military operations and be successful, depending on what it is they try to do. I mean, I think they will probably try to seize a corridor to link up Crimea and hold all the coastline if they conduct a military operation. But it's possible that they will conduct a full-scale operation. I think it's possible, but if I'm honest, I don't think it's probable, although the sort of mood music in the last couple of weeks would suggest that equation is shifting. But that moral component piece is absolutely crucial in the ability of the Ukrainian people and the Ukrainian military with their reserves, etc., to hold out and fight hard and give Russia, you know, a hard time. And I don't think, as David again alludes to, the Russian people are all that keen on another Afghanistan. So,
yeah, Tim Cross, we're going to have to leave it there. That's Major General Tim Cross was joining us. David Lidington, before that, the head of the RUSI think tank. Hopefully, you're slightly better informed now as to exactly what is going on in Russia. That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. We bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcast from?
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.